Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show. Welcome to the 252nd edition of Money Matters, entitled today, The June Bug, Investing into Summer. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. Before we begin, remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I, Mr. Cuniberti, am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and the opinions of any articles and the authors that wrote them that I may read on the show, or interviews for that matter. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Money Matters is about money. As money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, and some way or another controls the way we live our lives. It's about your money or lack of it or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. Well, welcome, welcome. We're going to cover a variety of things today. Well, we start out the show covering the markets. Today, if you're listening live, June 1st, 2017, 12:10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If you're listening to the show at a different time, the indices that I might mention may be at a different level than when I mentioned them right now. And for live call-in, 530-265-9555, 530-265-9555. Of course, if you're listening to this as a recording, which you could be later, then you can't call in. But you can always send your program director a note that they will pass to me. My name is Mark. Our website, moneymanagementradio.com. Our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. You'll find all sorts of market news on there. We don't spam you, sell your email address or anything. Just a way to get a newsletter, a grata. And also, you can download past shows there, a grata. And an occasional newscast. So, we're looking at the markets. Okay. So, we are over 21,000. And another simple reminder, these big numbers are support and resistance levels. So, when you're over 21,000, let's say we're at 21,104, up 95. The large number below us, 21,104, is regarded as support by technicians. And the number above us, the large number, is 22,000. That would reflect what we call resistance. Those are not chiseled in stone, and there are many support and resistance levels that are between those numbers. But big numbers are definitely numbers that people look at. So we busted through 21,000, stayed through it, and up again today. So we'll see. S&P stands at 2425. Who cares, right? Anybody knows what the S&P is or what the levels are. So what's going on in the news? Well, you know, typical stuff revolving around our president. Like him or love him or hate him. There you go. I guess we had a comedian coming in here Grass Valley on the 16th of June. Show emanates from Grass Valley, Nevada City, California, Nevada County. Why they call it Nevada County in California, I don't know. There's a story behind it, but I ain't going to tell it. And this particular comedian, Kathy Griffin, I believe her name was scheduled to come here, but I guess she did a video of a mock-up of somebody's head cut off. And that didn't set well with a lot of people. And so they canceled her here. And I guess she was on CNN. I guess she was a CNN spokesperson or going to host something. I don't know. But they severed ties with her. And then she did come out and apologize, saying, I went too far. You think? I wonder if somebody did that when Obama was president and held one of his heads there. I wonder what everybody would have thought. It's despicable, no matter who it is. It's just despicable. We have enough of that in the world in real life, right? And I saw in the news today, there was an alleged shooting, explosions at a Philippine resort called World Resorts, I believe. So we'll follow the news on that. I'm on Yahoo Finance right now. I don't see anything on that right now, although the big thing is the President Trump to address U.S. participation in Paris Climate Accord, whether he's going to accept it or back out of it. So we'll see there. And from Yahoo Finance, Ford stock gains on May sales. That's today's charts from Yahoo Finance, coming from Yahoo Finance. And Lululemon, clothing manufacturer, earnings and on tap and Palo Alto Networks, the cybersecurity forum, I guess, is scheduled to release today. So we'll see how that goes. No, not a cold. I think it's allergies. A lot of that green stuff. In fact, I'm looking in the studio here today. There's dust all over the place. So there you go. So I am watching these markets carefully, more carefully than I did 2 or 3 months ago. For a variety of opinionated reasons. These are opinions only. This market run since Trump has been elected has been rather brisk, up about 4,000 points, I believe, since he's been elected, and continues to keep going. And, of course, I've read dozens of articles saying that it can go farther. And I've read dozens of articles saying that it could revert because it's just too extended. So I don't know, but I am watching carefully and installing what we call trailing stops on any profitable positions we may have. And so I am watching them carefully. A trailing stop is basically a stop on a stock as it goes up and you have profits in it. Hopefully you install a stop below it, so if it starts to drop and starts to take some of your profits away, you are out, or hopefully out. When you put a stop order in, it becomes a market order, which means you might not get out at your stop price. That gets a little more complicated, so you can always send me an email. I can explain that to you, or just go onto the website, and things are explained there. So I am vigilant, for sure. I am vigilant, watching our portfolios and ready to pull the trigger. If I sense something maybe up, I want to keep any profits that we may have, of course. So looking at that and being careful. Some areas are interesting to me that I'm also looking at. Some of the overseas markets I'm looking at carefully. And so we'll take a look. We'll continue to watch the markets for you and just kind of stay abreast of what's going on. And so although I only come on twice a month to do newscasts once a week, sometimes shows radio stations air the newscast a little bit more often, so just kind of stay in tune or check out the website if you like, and we'll see. The June bug, investing into summer. So, well, one of the other reasons I'm watching these markets is the old adage, sell in May and go away, basically reflects the theory only, of course, that by selling stocks in May and rebuying them in November, you'll make more money than if you hold them all year round. Well, that's a theory, and so you can check out your own historical precedents to see how well that has held up. But summer is a time when it is reported that many traders in New York and all over the world, of course, go on vacation, go to the Hamptons, drive their Maseratis, and stay out in the Hamptons and buy diamond jewelry and things of this sort. So They traditionally trading slows down and markets sometimes don't go anywhere. So I'm watching that. We're just entering into June, so market's still up today. So go figure this, right? So I am watching it more vigilantly than I did a few months ago. So we've covered the term quantitative easing. Quantitative easing. You know, I call this show Money Matters, but it's revolved a lot around money printing. Of course, if I called the show Money Printing, that would have been a little bit more specific. So Money Matters, I think, was just a more appropriate name. Been on the air since 2005. 12 years. Wow. Boy, they went fast. 252 shows and close to 900 newscasts, an untold number of newsletters and articles that I've written for various publications throughout the state, and a variety of seminars. We have a seminar coming up. I'll tell you about that later. I have to get permission of the producer of the seminar. It's a closed seminar. Don't know if I can announce it to the public or not, but I'll find that out. And we're planning another seminar coming up. And these are all agrata seminars, because there's no fees or anything like that. Just educational seminars. No sales pitches or nothing like that. We just like to educate the public, and that's why I do the show. So the term quantitative easing. You've probably heard the term here, also known as QE in the local media and in public media and worldwide media, indeed. Refers to those who have listened to the show many times, and for those who are just tuning in for the first time, refers to a government's ability to create currency with a touch of a keystroke. Just push a button and you create money in the government coffers. Commonly called money printing. The ability to create something for free while the rest of us have to work for it is deemed necessary in order for the powers that be here in the United States, that's the Federal Reserve, to control the economy. That the economy can be controlled by a central body, of course, is a subject for another day. But some people believe that it can be, and the issue of money creation brings into play many market dynamics. So when I say money printing or quantitative easing, it's usually done by the central bank, and they believe they can control the economy by doing such things as creating money from air. When a government prints dollars, it causes the quantity of dollars in the economy to increase, right? If they print $10 trillion more dollars, there's $10 trillion more dollars floating around in the economy. Much like a bumper crop of bananas, increasing the quantity of bananas causes the price of bananas to fall. In other words, if you had bananas and they were worth $2 a pound, and it started raining bananas, well, obviously the price of your bananas would not be worth much if they could get a lot of bananas for free, right? Pick them up off the street. The same goes for dollars. Increase the quantity of dollars, and the price of each dollar falls. That's basic economics 101. Whether that happens immediately or in the far or medium-term future remains to be seen, of course. But when you increase the quantity of dollars, the price of each dollar falls in value. Now, what does that mean? The fall in value of the price of a dollar? You really don't know what that means. How does a dollar bill fall in value if it still says a dollar bill? Well, that is exhibited. The fall of the dollar, or the fall of its value, is exhibited through its loss of purchasing power. So its loss of purchasing power, the dollar won't buy as much. We call that what? Inflation, right? Inflation. The inflation, now here's the trick though, the inflation is currency specific, right? In other words, if I'm holding bananas and it rains bananas, the price of bananas go down, but not the price of apples. So if we have U.S. dollars, Central Bank of the United States prints more U.S. dollars, the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar falls. But does the purchasing power of an apple fall, or does the purchasing power of a Swiss franc fall, or does the purchasing power of a euro fall? Well, if we're only printing U.S. dollars, then the theory would be extrapolated out to mean that only the purchasing power of the dollar that's being printed falls in value. So if you print more Swiss francs, for example, the price of something might go up only in Swiss francs. So what happens to the price of a good when a particular country prints a lot? What happens to the price of a good when you price it in other currencies? Well, the theory would go on to say if I print a lot of U.S. dollars and U.S. dollars lose value, and therefore it takes more U.S. dollars to buy something, it wouldn't affect Swiss francs or it wouldn't affect euro dollars. Now, that's theory. In actuality, in the real world, things do interact. But we're just talking about theory here, so keep that in mind. Since currencies can be arbitrarily created by willing governments, right? The willing government, they can create currency, right? Nothing stops them. The measuring stick of the value of each currency now is essentially measured against other currencies. Now, we used to measure it against gold, but we don't usually do that anymore. Years and years ago, you could look up the price of U.S. dollar and it would be reflected in the price of gold. Now we don't look at that anymore. They are, for the most part, the currencies measured against each other. So as an example only, when the U.S. dollar goes down, the Swiss franc would likely go up in value, right? Because if Swiss franc and U.S. dollars are measured against each other, when you print a lot more U.S. dollars, Swiss franc would go up in value and relative to the U.S. dollar. This is not, as I mentioned, exclusive or automatic, and there are many factors at play, but you get the picture. We don't measure currencies against gold right now, for the most part. We measure it against other currencies. A product bought using U.S. dollars, a product's price bought using U.S. dollars may rise in price in U.S. dollars, which means the U.S. are printing more dollars, so the purchasing power of each dollar is falling. While the same price product, same product purchased in Swiss francs may fall. So there's the opposite reaction there. This opposite or inverse relationship of currencies has a unique effect when it comes to exports, what we sell to foreigners, and imports, what we buy from foreigners. So if the United States prints more dollars and thus causes inflation here, which is the falling value of the U.S. dollar, it is said that our currency gets weaker. So if we print more dollars and we see inflation, it is said that our currency, the U.S. dollar, would get weaker. Weaker, right? That would make things that we buy from other countries more expensive. Our imports that we buy would cost more. Take more U.S. dollars to buy something we brought in from another country. But conversely, if we print a lot of dollars and we see inflation here, now listen carefully, it makes our exports cheaper to foreigners. So when we print money here, we sell a Caterpillar tractor over there. If we see our dollar get weaker, right, then that Caterpillar tractor is cheaper to foreigners because their currency got stronger in relation to ours. See how that is? So our currency got weaker, which means their currency got stronger, which they means they can buy more Caterpillar tractors or whatever was selling over there for fewer foreign dollars. By printing more dollars here in the United States, our U.S.-based corporations tend to make more money because they sell more overseas because their products are cheaper when bought by foreigners. Kind of convoluted. Draw it on a piece of paper, you could see it. But when we weaken our dollar here, it also means that you and I have a weaker dollar, so we have to pay more for everything we buy using a U.S. dollar. If we had Swiss francs, they'd become stronger. But if we're holding U.S. dollars and they get weaker, it means we got to need more dollars to buy whatever we're going to buy. And we know that as what? Inflation. So for you conspiracy buffs out there, if the government was for the corporations, by the corporations, and of the corporations, a propensity or willingness for a government to print money would seem to confirm that they are for, by, and of the corporations. Because if we print more money, the dollar here falls, what we sell overseas, the corporations sell overseas, gets cheaper, which means people will buy more. So if we print money, our corporations that sell overseas should theoretically sell more stuff. So if the government was in cahoots with corporations, it would do what? Weaken the dollar so the corporation could sell more. And what do we see? So that's for you conspiracy buffs out there, okay? That corporations are evil. By printing more U.S. dollars, our corporations here in the United States theoretically do sell more. But since this inverse relationship makes the other foreigner's currency stronger, then foreign goods that are sold here get more expensive to us. This causes foreign corporations to sell less to us. So they get hurt. We print more money. Our dollar weakens. What we sell overseas gets cheaper, so our corporations sell more. But with the other foreign corporations then can't sell as much to us because we have a weaker dollar, so it costs us more to buy a Swiss watch. So what happens is these foreign corporations, since the United States is the largest market in the world, right, fastly being approached by China, these foreign corporations get quite upset, and they go to their governments and they say, look, the United States print a lot of money. Now our products are more expensive over there in the United States, so we need you guys to print up money. So it'll weaken our currency so that our exports to the United States will get cheaper again. So overseas central banks then listen to their corporations if they are of, for, and by their corporations. They in turn weaken their currency by printing, so their goods get cheaper again here. And it goes back and forth. It's a tit for tat, as they say. This tit for tat encompasses policymakers worldwide. If the United States prints a lot of money and weakens their dollar, then other countries go, well, wait a minute. That was easy. We'll do the same thing. And our corporations will again sell more to the United States. So it's a war, and it's been entitled by myself and many other authors and media producers a currency war or the grand money printing race. It's a currency war. And you look up currency wars, you'll see this is what it means. Countries printing their own currency to make their dollars cheaper so their exports are cheaper so they sell more. So it goes back and forth. The U.S., of course, is the biggest dog in the pack. It's the largest money printer in the world. In essence, when the U.S. embarks on massive money printing to fund itself for social programs or for infrastructure or even just to support the corporations, it forces the rest of the world to do the same. It's a grand race to devalue each other's currency against the other's currency so everyone's corporations sell more stuff. But it just goes back and forth. The end result is what? If you do it, then I do it, and you do it, and I do it, and you do it. Well, nothing happens, really, except prices continue to rise on both sides of the borders. What it does do is it dooms the population of each nation to higher prices overall because more dollars have been created on both sides of the border. So in conclusion, you could say the U.S. is the biggest importer in the world. In other words, we buy a lot of stuff, and when we buy that stuff, the dollars flow overseas, so we're exporting dollars. We export Caterpillar tractors, of course, but we also export dollars because we buy all this imported stuff. Those dollars fly over to China and wherever they go. And so it could be said that we export dollars. We're flooding the world with dollars. So if we flood the other countries with dollars, if we flood the world with dollars, we are actually flooding the world with what? Inflation. Right? An argument could be made that the end result is that the United States is exporting its inflation through its massive money printing machine. Interesting. And it is. You listen to your Money Matters on Community Radio Station. We will be right back with more Money Matters. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one. And you're tuned to Money Matters right here on your community radio station, edition 252, entitled The June Bug, Investing into Summer. And this minute, Donald Trump has taken the stage to talk about the Environmental Accord, so we'll see if I can get a headline on that when it comes through the board here. So in the world of investing, it's a common term, not so common among average investors, but those that follow the markets, watch CNBC or whatever you watch. There are two types of investing environments. They're opposite investment environments. It's often referred to in the media as risk on and risk off. So we're either in one environment or the other. We're either on the risk on or risk off, or in transition between the two. When they say risk on, I always like to think of game on. That's the way I like to think, game on. So when you see risk on, you see game on. Game on, risk on means, refers to a positive outlook from investors as it pertains to the stock markets and the economies that drive those markets. Game on. Risk off, I'd never known the term game off, but risk off, I would deem as get the hell out. Risk off is the opposite environment of risk on. So it's either risk on, risk off, game on, or get the hell out, or in transition between the two. So risk off is the opposite of risk on, whereas when the term risk off is used, it means there is a higher level of trepidation about economic conditions and therefore the financial markets in general by investors. During risk on, game on, investors are said to be more inclined to purchase higher risk assets, which may have a higher potential for gains. Assets deemed, let's say, preferable during risk on might include such things as stocks and stock funds. Put simply, if investors are confident in the business and stock market climates, right? Climates, they are willing to take on more risk in exchange for the chance of higher gains. Risk on, game on. We're willing to take on more risk in exchange for the chance of higher gains. Influencing factors causing a risk on, game on environment might include favorable or low interest rates, little or no political upheaval, both domestic and foreign, of course. In other words, the political climate is calm. Healthy consumer spending and encouraging economic statistics from the reporting agencies. In other words, they're coming around going, yeah, people are spending, looks good. People say, okay, risk on, game on, we're into stocks and stocks funds. Now, should one or more of these factors turn negative or appear to be deteriorating, right? It's like, oh, they're not spending as much, and no, interest rates are starting to rise. The investing public may begin to suspect things may worsen in any number of areas. This means with the specter of possible economic malaise on the horizon, a risk-off, get the hell out, mentality may take hold. Risk-off. The change from a risk-on to a risk-off mentality can be sudden, such as the 9/11 attack, right? Everything's going gangbusters and then wham, and everybody's like, holy mackerel. This is going to upset the world markets. We got to get out. It could be an economic event, such as the folding of a major bank. Serious political strife, right? We could have political or geopolitical problem. You know, Korea could, that nut over there could launch a missile somewhere. Those would be, those might cause a sudden shift from risk on to risk off. Or it can be a gradual shift. We gradually go to a more pessimistic nature, which might be brought on by deteriorating economic statistics, right? It was like, well, you know, their bad employment numbers keep getting worse, or overseas markets are starting to fall, and there could be contagion bleeding over to domestic markets. Could be a number of things that just changes the mindset over time to a risk-off mentality. Now, in recent years, I mean, we've seen this risk on, risk off, rather sudden swings, these things, like, you know, like risk on, all of a sudden Dow drops 400 points, risk off. By the way, President Trump announces the United States will exit the Paris Climate Accord. That's just been posted on yahoofinance.com. So the shift from risk on to risk off could be sudden or gradual. Okay? And my take on it is, over the last couple of decades, maybe the last decade, decade and a half, it's been rather sudden shifts. You know, it's like, wow, up 400, down 500. The possible catalysts for these, for an economic surge, both positive and negative, in other words, economic surges is a positive surge, markets and economies go up, and it could be negative, it's like, oh, everything's going down in the tank. The possible catalyst for any of those movements is, there are many of them. And all we have to do is, you need an example, just think back to any number of events in our recent or not so recent past where you've seen the markets fall, or you've seen the markets get railed, or you've seen the markets run to dizzying new heights, and you think, well, what caused those, right? What caused those things to happen? Well, we could see a risk-off deteriorating condition was in the housing market. That was deteriorating condition. When Trump got elected, apparently the markets loved it, and it was a risk-on environment. Or you could see it a sudden risk-on, risk-off environment, like the 9/11 attacks, such as what I just detailed. The importance of understanding risk-on and risk-off environments is not to be underestimated, especially to you advisors out there. If it's a temporary risk-on or risk-off, those are the things that are hard to tell. Are we seeing a temporary setback in an otherwise bull market, or are we seeing a switch in the overall mentality and perception of investors worldwide or domestically that's moving from one environment to the other? That's the trick, right? See the market go down 150 points, do you sell? Does it mean risk off is coming, or is it just a temporary blurb? That's the key. Now, although individual investors may not be as educated on risk on and risk off environments, advisors certainly should be. And if you're handling your own portfolios, then of course. But I think anybody that has any money should understand these two concepts of risk on, risk off, because they are. What they do is they introduce something what we call general market risk. General market risk means no matter what stock you have, if the markets are running up, they may have a propensity to run with them. And if the markets fall hard, general market risk is explained as, if the markets are falling hard, you're at a general market risk of losing money in whatever stock you own. That's general market risk. There are other risks that we talk about, political risks and individual company risks, and a lot of other risks, but this risk on, risk off generally refers to the general market risk. So if you are holding cash or cash equivalents in a risk on environment, game on, well, you may not see the gains that others see. And if we're seeing a lot of risk-on environments, we may see inflationary environment, and of course money sitting in cash doesn't yield anything. If we see a risk-off environment, or starting to change to a risk-off environment, and you're holding all stocks, you could be subject to risk there if the general market falls. Because certain asset classes may have a tendency to sell off, rise, or remain stable during these two opposite environments. In other words, there are certain asset classes that have historical patterns that say, okay, when it's risk on, these generally rise and these generally fall. In a risk on environment, there are things that fall in the markets. Not all things rise in a risk on environment. And in a risk off environment, not all things fall. And knowing what falls and what rises in either of these two opposing environments is important. And how do you know? Well, we look at the historical patterns of such asset classes. You know, what has happened in the past? You look at tremendous risk-off environments, you know, very pessimistic times when the general market fell. You look for things that rose. What rose during those environments? And then see if it rose in the last one and the one before that. And then you might have an historical precedent to say, hey, these always rise when the market panics. And vice versa. When the market runs, these fall. So there are opposite asset classes that historically have a tendency to either reflect the general direction or move in opposite of it. Now, the caveat here, and we must include this for the people that listen to the show, the regulatory bodies say that historical performance is no guarantee of future results. Okay? So we must remember that. Historical performance is no guarantee of future results. And no one can say for certain what will rise. No one can say for certain what will fall. And no one can say for certain what will remain stable in these two environments. While historical performance is no guarantee of future results, I said it twice, you regulators out there, who I love dearly, never cross the regulators. Seeing what things have done in the past, seeing what asset classes have done in the past in both environments could yield some clues as to the mindset of what investors buy and sell in each environment. Because when an investor or a large investment company sells something, they cash out, and they don't put the cash in a bag under the desk. They have to place it somewhere. They don't place it in the bank, generally in a savings account, a retail savings account, because it's, what's the insurance? $250,000, right? Well, what if I'm trying to protect $500 million? What do I do with it? So what happens is that when they sell in a risk-off environment, game off, get the hell out, they place that money somewhere. And historically, they place it in familiar asset classes. And conversely, when risk on arrives, game on, they have to raise cash to buy stocks. So they sell certain things which fall in value if sold, right? When something is sold, it falls and it means there's more coming on the market. And that generally means lower prices. So risk-off assets, risk-on assets, let's correct that, risk-on assets, game-on assets, risk-on assets may be thought to include stocks and other traditional investments, while risk-off assets may be as simple as holding more cash or perhaps U.S. debt instruments. And there are other areas as well, but those are the most easy to understand. Risk on may mean let's go into stocks. Risk off means let's get out of stocks and go into cash or other investment areas. There are no hard and fast rules I can flat out list in the context of the show because of regulations and also because of time, right? We could do 4 hours on this. But a knowledgeable financial professional and those knowledgeable personal, you know, private investors will know what this means. And if you don't know what it means, they should be able to enlighten you as to what exactly it means and what assets might you hold in either of these two environments. You know, what can I buy during a risk-on environment? What should I sell in a risk-off environment? What should I buy in a risk-off environment, and what should I sell in a risk-on environment? So the environments are the two environments are pretty easy to conceptualize. Risk-on, game on. Risk-off, get the hell out. But now that you've heard this blurb, get the hell out means only get the hell out of certain things, right? You can actually say risk-off means get the hell out of certain things and buy other things. So, as in all things, I've always said, one of the Marxisms is, knowledge is the cornerstone of progress. Knowledge is the cornerstone of progress. And the more we know, the better off we will be, or should be. An investor or advisors or anyone that understands market dynamics, such as the risk on, risk off environments, may be better equipped to make more informed and therefore better financial decisions when it comes to managing your money, right? The more you know, the better you should be. As always, be sure to consult with a financial professional before making any investment decisions and do your own research before investing. Of course, I have to say that. So, in any case, you're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station, and we'll be right back to wrap up the show with a little bit more on the Trump tax reforms, if we get enough time. Okay, so if we're quick, we'll cover the Trump tax reforms. We got a little bit more time. Trump tax reforms are finally on the table. Well, sort of. They're big in rhetoric, like Trump, but lacking in real detail. No, I won't say it there, too. The rough draft of the tax reforms is particularly causing the usual rifts between the parties. And, of course, I penned this last week, and they probably change from here. Although his ideas on reform seem to be changing weekly as the public response is measured by the grand old White House, the stated mission is often used, tax reform. You know, I don't confuse tax reform with simplifying the tax code, which means reducing the 74,000 pages in the IRS code book. That might be one concept most people would agree on as far as tax returns, yet Trump's tax reform is not reducing the actual tax codes, but reducing the actual taxes paid in general. The proposals in Trump's reforms will no doubt be altered if and when it actually gets through the political process. Here they are in the condensed form. Okay, the proposals only. I highly doubt that these will go through in their current state. Cut corporate taxes from the current 35% to 15%. Increase the standard deduction 100% to $25,000. Repeal the estate tax in its entirety. Eliminate the 3.8 surcharge on dividends and capital gains which fund Obamacare. Simplify by reducing the existing personal income tax deductions. Reducing personal income tax deductions. The implementation of this reform means eliminating all personal deductions now currently allowed. Whoa. The exception being mortgage interest paid, charitable deductions, and retirement contributions. These are the three most commonly used deductions by the majority of Americans, so it's no wonder Trump did not target these. Most of these reforms, if implemented, are revenue negative, which means U.S. government will make less money in the beginning. So many are saying, how are you going to pay for all this? Well, I always find that laughable. How are we going to pay for it? We never pay for anything, do we? How are we going to pay for it? Nobody's really talked about budget restraint in years. So, but that's the way I wrote it. The printing press notwithstanding, in other words, just print the money to pay for everything, which is what we like to do. Real solutions on how to make up the losses are a subject of debate, of course. Treasury Secretary suggests loss revenue will be paid for by an increase in economic activity. This is the proverbial trickle-down theory, which says an increase in economic growth will yield more tax revenue over time. Advocates of this may be referring to what we call the Laffer curve. It's not L-A-U-G-H-E-R, if I spelled that right, potato or potato. The Laffer curve was developed by supply-side economist Arthur Laffer, okay? And what it says is this demonstrates that there's an optimum tax rate for the highest revenue. In other words, if on the left-hand side of the curve you charge no tax, the government will collect nothing. On the right-hand chart, you collect 100% tax of everything that everybody makes, then therefore there won't be anything made, and the government will end up collecting nothing because nobody will be able to live. So, the Laffer curve that says that there is an optimum rate. You, if you charge too little or charge too much, revenue will suffer to the government. So there is a sweet spot. Can't charge more, can't charge less. There is a sweet spot. That's the Laffer curve. Of course, those that are against are not really in support of the Laffer curve. Is one of them is the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. They say that these tax reforms, if implemented in their current form, will to lop off about $5.5 trillion of revenue that the government would have collected. No doubt opinions differ on what side of the aisle you reside on, and of course, which economic theory or model you believe. I'm of the opinion that the Laffer curve, at least, is to be believed. The Laffer curve. However, the trick is knowing exactly where on the curve we are now and after the proposed cuts. And to that, I have an opinion, but no answer to. So, you have been listening to Money Matters, and it's been my pleasure to bring the information to you, disseminate the information in a way that it's easy to understand. It is still on Yahoo Finance that the U.S. will exit the Paris Climate Accord. Now, the Dow has climbed only 23 points, or has climbed 23 points, since he made that announcement. Does that mean that the investment world is in support of it? I don't know. 23 points one way or the other doesn't seem like any real conviction has been moved. So, we'll see. We will pray that the incident in the Philippines at the World Resorts, I believe if that's what it's called, is resolved. I don't know. What do we say about horrors like that? It's just incredible. And so, again, our website, moneymanagementradio.com, Agrata. You can download shows, get the newsletter, Agrata. It's just... you're listening to the show on a community radio station. It's our way of saying thank you for listening. And, of course, please go to the website. Well, let's say like this. I don't think I can say that. The websites for your community radio stations are on the web, so you can check them out to find out how you can support, listen, get involved with your community radio station, or your community, for that matter. A couple of weeks ago, we did an interview with the Foster Family Agency locally here. So if you'd like to listen to that show, you can grab that show as well at moneymanagementradio.com. And that is another way we can invest, not our money, but investing in the community. We got a lot of good positive response on that. My name is Mark Cunaberti. I must remind you, as I do at the end of every show, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I, Mark Charles Cunaberti, am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff members, or underwriters. This has been show number 252, entitled The June Bug, Investing in the Summer. Take care. We'll watch the market so you don't have to. God bless everyone out there. Have a great day.
Get back.